For sharks.
Okay, ready? Yep. Okay, today is Wednesday, March 18th, 2015. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2015. Robin, will you please summarize the bill?
Sure. Oh, dear. Let me, I need just a minute. So sorry.
I know. I need it.
Missing one SMS. One second, my apology.
I bet you our vice chair could almost summarize it at this point.
I probably could, but I won't.
We're honored to have our speaker.
I just looked through this.
Right. We're going to summarize the bill in a few more minutes, but in the meantime, I know the speaker's schedule is very busy. Would love to have some opening comments, and in particular, if you could speak to the Dash 7 amendments. But please start out with a broader statement of what this is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. It's really nice to be back. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. Good to be back. And I will walk through the Dash 7, which I think we'll get through the contents of the bill again. So, and I think, you know, we've had some time to talk about this bill. And first of all, I want to thank the chair and everyone on the committee for their really helpful feedback on the bill. And the Dash 7 reflects some of the conversations we've been having, and I'm really glad about that. And just the time to make sure the amendment is right, make sure the fiscal impact statement is right. So it hopefully today, you with your support, it moves on to Ways and Means. So let me start with the Dash 7 amendment. You should have that online. It does a couple things. I'll just kind of point out there's some, it's a little longer than the bill, actually, so let me just point out the important parts. On page 1 in lines 5, 6, and 7, some language will be added to the overall support of the bill. If you remember, this bill is about strengthening the employment-related daycare program to try to make it work better for families. And one of the things we wanted to make sure, and I talked about this in my first testimony, but it wasn't really reflected in the bill, so we're adding language that says, this is the department will work on making sure that exit eligibility and co-pays for the programs must be structured to mitigate the financial impact of reduced subsidy support due to increased income. So remember, we talked about that cliff effect. At some point when a family's been on for a year and they're making a little more income and we want to have continuity of care for the child, the department will have the latitude to figure out how to mitigate the changes in income to keep that family on the program longer. So that directs specifically the department to do that. Lines 13, 14, and 15, one of the things that we've talked about on and off over the years is making sure under federal requirements that we continue to provide enough access to affordable child care. And because the bulk of this program is funded by federal funds, the Child Care Block Grant, the feds require a certain percentage of market care to be available. And so this just says the department shall work to meet federal recommendations for income eligibility and market access in regard to employment-related child care administered by the department. Might sound simple. It's been a problem over the years making sure the income eligibility and access to the market is still fair and available so we can meet our federal requirements. So that is why that was added. There were a few things we needed to fix, making sure we had the right providers named in the bill, so there's a few technical things. The next big section is there's some existing statute that is going to get included into the bill, so we can add the section that appears on the end of page 3 of the Dash 7, sub 5 there. This says to the department, we want to make sure we're improving quality in the family, friends, and neighbor network of care. These are the license-exempt providers. So the department will be tasked with working on a system of quality supports for exempt family child care providers, and it talks about evidence-based practices and best practices. Also allows for both in-person and through the internet practices for this system of providers. That is an important part of what we do. We have licensed providers and we have license-exempt providers, and they provide care for a lot of children, so we want to move a quality effort in that section of the provider system as well. Because, you know, in the original bill, we talk about provider incentives and family incentives to use your subsidy to use some programs that would be in the quality rating system. Quality rating system only applies for licensed care. So this says to the department, go develop a system of quality improvements for the non-licensed providers who are out there. And then following that, in section 4 on page 5, near the end of the page, you see additional language that says, what we're not doing is also providing an incentive for those families in family, friend, and neighbor care to choose higher quality providers. So the department will be tasked with working on that and coming back as well. It's a much more diffuse system of providers. We've done less work in deciding what is quality and how do you promote quality in that system, but we want to make sure it happens. That's why you see the additional language. We call for a report back in the legislative interim committees on the quality supports for family, friend, and neighbor care. So you, as the committee, will continue to get reports from the department. And then an emergency clause was added because we realize it's difficult to get started on these things if it goes into implementation January 1 of next year. So we added an emergency clause. So the Dash 7 amendment has a fiscal impact statement. It's quite long. It is thorough. It has 5 pages. And I want to thank everybody. Well, first of all, the Dash 7 amendments, I want to thank everybody, but Representative Stark, we had great conversations about the family, friend, and neighbor care, so I really appreciate his input. We want to make sure quality in that system, the right incentives are there. We don't want to disadvantage that set of providers over licensed providers. We want quality for whatever care setting you choose. So the fiscal, I want to thank legislative fiscal and all the departments involved, DHS, Department of Ed, OHA, and the Employment Department. They're all in here. This is a very thorough fiscal statement. I wanted to make sure that when you pass this on, and I hope you do, two ways and means, everybody knows what the cost is involved in doing these programmatic changes as well as some other things. So overall, it talks about all the different, it's a really nice summary of everything the bill would do. It talks about what it would cost, including some FTE. I want to point out, though, on page 3 of the fiscal, under additional provisions of the bill, because I think one of the things that's not crystal clear in the bill, there's the actual things the bill will require to do and the cost. And then there are those other things we also want to do at the same time. So we direct the department to come up with a way to mitigate the cliff effect in the second year. We don't really say at what income level. So you see in the sub A there under additional provisions on page 3, you find out what income level the department is basing their assumptions on. It says that in the second year, you could make up to 250% of the federal poverty line and still be in the program. So we want to make sure people could see the assumptions that are being built into the fiscal statement. Under sub B, it also provides the dollar amounts for providing care at the 75th percentile, the access that the federal dollars are required to provide. Also talks about doing more. So this isn't just about strengthening the program, it's also serving more families. And while it's not actually in the bill itself, we want to make sure that if we were going to expand the number of families served by as many as 1,750 more families, trying to get to a 10,000 per month caseload threshold, that costs about $33 million to do. So the very last line there before, right above the Oregon Health Authority table, it says the collective budgetary impact of the bill's provisions and other program improvements would be about $62 million in general fund. So to do this program right by parents, to include those families who have been excluded, like the self-employed parents, and help families who are also taking classes, to do the things around quality, to serve more families, make sure we have market access, to do this right, this whole package as an overall investment would be $62 million. It's not exactly what you're approving today, but I wanted you to know that if we were going to do this right, that is the total package deal. And I thought that was helpful for you to see, and I really appreciate legislative fiscal doing the due diligence of providing all that information for you. So thank you. I hope with your support, we'll move it on to Ways and Means for further consideration, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Questions? Representative Stark.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Kenegeyer. I'm curious, on the increasing the caseload to 10,000 cases.
Yes.
You know, this is in the fiscal. Why 10,000? Where's that number come from?
Chair Kenegeyer. Vice Chair Stark, it is arbitrary to some degree. We would always want to do more. And so to take us to that next level, it seems like we're at 8,000 now if we can get to 10,000, but it's really would come down to what we can afford. But I wanted to give a ballpark number. There's been a lot of interest in trying to get to that caseload number. We were close to that pre-recession.
Okay.
And then we had the wait list and other things, so we haven't been able to maintain that.
I have a follow-up question to that. Weren't we above 10,000 at some point years ago?
Madam Chair, we might have been. I don't remember that. DHS could probably clarify that. So.
Okay.
That's by recollection. So we're trying to restore to a certain level.
Right. Other questions? Representative Buehler?
Just a comment. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for all your hard work on this. I think this is an excellent piece of legislation. And Representative Kenny Geyer and I have talked many times about it, and I think it's the type of thing we need to do to help families, especially those families on the in poverty or on the verge of poverty. I think this is one of the most important anti-poverty things we'll do this session, in my opinion. Most meaningful.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Representative.
Representative
Pete? Chair Kenny Geyer, thank you. Could you walk me through what the financial flow would be from the funds available? Goes to the daycare in regards to qualified daycare versus somebody that's not in a, like the friends or family helping with the daycare. What is the proposed process?
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, I might need you to clarify, you know, a certain amount of the dollars goes directly to the providers. There's also parent co-pays. There is some dollars, there are dollars available for example, the study to analyze how we move to a quality incentive program for family, friends, and neighbors. So maybe you can maybe
speak more specific. I'm talking about the dollars to the daycare. How does that process work? Is that on a monthly basis, and then the parents pay a copay with that? And then if we include some of the, I understand, I could be incorrect, that some of the daycare dollars may go to outside of those qualified daycare or you know, grandparents or others. How would that process be proposed to work?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, I'll take a stab at it, but you might have experts behind me. You can do a better job. Roughly half the children in employment-related daycare, maybe more than half, are in family, friends, and neighbor care, licensed-exempt providers.
Right.
So they do receive a subsidy directly from the department, I believe on a monthly basis, as well as the parents do the copay. Same thing on the license side. But that is, it's a direct pay unit in the Department of Human Services that pays the provider, and then it's up to the provider to collect the copay from the parent.
Thank you.
Would anyone here like to call up DHS to ask any further questions? I am hoping that people come out of here with really clear conviction about this. I will say I think this is one of the most important bills for if you care about people in poverty, which if you're on this committee, you probably do. If you want to support young families, if you want to support businesses who are depending on their employees to have quality care, reliable care for their employees, this is really critical. And I hope that you all will be messengers about this. For people who are not on this committee, and I want people to come out of here with as much clarity about this as possible, would you like to have DHS answer any specific questions?
I'm good.
They are all officially experts on employment.
Okay. Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. Just kind of something to put out on the record. Previously, when we had the hearing on this, I was concerned about in the original bill, and I still am concerned, from the original bill, lines 17 through 19 discuss basically if a parent is to choose a higher quality rated provider, that they would have reduced copays. I feel like that is going to give an unfair advantage to agency and Granny Smith. It may put Granny Smith at a disadvantage. And I see the need to want to encourage Granny Smith to get that quality training. But I was concerned that you would force a parent to choose one way or another. Part of the Dash 7 amendments, Section 4, is an attempt to resolve that. In my opinion, it doesn't fully resolve it, but it says we will watch it. And so Section 4 of the Dash 7 amendments basically says we're going to watch and see if this has a negative impact, because there's a difference of opinion on whether it will or won't. And so they're saying, well, we'll watch it, we'll check it, and I just want to throw out there, we will pay close attention and make sure that Granny Smith is not even put at a disadvantage on this, but I'm glad to see that we're addressing it in one way or another.
And Madam Chair, I think it's an excellent addition to the bill, and I'm really looking forward to when we come back in the interim to find out what the study shows and say, what is the best way to incentivize that set of families who we have the quality rating system is an established system. It's obvious how to get into that system. It's not obvious how we would somehow create a list of more quality family providers. I mean, there are things we can
right.
do, and it'll be really interesting to see what they come back with, and I'm really looking forward to that discussion.
My bet's on Granny Smith. No one's going to, you know, go around her because they have a less of a copay somewhere else, is my guess. But we'll see. Any other comments on this? I just want to summarize some of the comments I have heard both from you now as well as people in the committee who discuss this. Some of the things that I think are really important in this particular bill are that it does include students and self-employed. Those are categories that we've left out, and yet we know that they need child care if they're going to advance in their careers. It counts toward the block grant. I think that's really important with all the child care bills that we're looking at. Increasing access, so market share. You know, if we're only hitting, if our copay is only allowing people to hit 35% of what is out there in the open market, that's a really hard. First of all, it's not aligning with what the federal requirements are. But secondly, and more importantly, it means that we're really restricting the kind of childcare, quality childcare that families can access. And we're not saying we're going to pay you 100% of the market. You can have any choice out there. You can go to Fruit and Flower. But we are saying that we've got to give more access. So I think that's a really important step. I think the stability, the 1 year, that people, once they're on it, can be on it for 1 year, is really critical. People, if they fall on and off, we know what that bonding attachment does between providers and youth, so I think that's incredibly important. The CLIF, that's something that this committee has cared a lot about. We're looking at it with TANF and ERDC and the child care tax credits. The quality rating, I think this is, you know, we've gone a long way in ERDC reflecting, and we're not there yet on our child care tax credits. This is kind of our one avenue to really attach, trying to incentivize higher quality, and we'll see what that means in the family, friend, and neighbor category. But I think that's, it's critical that, you know, we want to support that kind of child care with our state dollars. I think the monthly payments is something that we are able to do with this that is a much harder challenge in the child care tax credit arena, and being able to help families with monthly relief as opposed to waiting at the end of the year. There's been a lot of support on this committee for that. So those are just some of the pieces I've heard about this bill that policy-wise are really important. I know $62 million is a challenge, and it's going to get to Ways and Means, and you know, I hope people have enough conviction about this that they'll weigh in and try to support it to the degree that we can. But I think it's a fabulous bill, and I know there's been a lot of work, your personal time into it, and then a lot of people on this committee, as well as many advocates and DHS and others. So.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I would particularly like to thank my Deputy Legislative Director, Dorothy Spence, who's been living and breathing this bill for months.
Right there. So. Yep. Thank you, Dorothy. Yeah.
Yep. So, thank you, Chair. Another just comment to throw out there. The original 12-month eligibility, one of the things that I asked about, well, is that just a guarantee? Can someone just get, you know, it doesn't matter what they do? There's actually a whole handful of things that can disqualify someone from that eligibility. So it's not just a guarantee. It's basically saying if they're on and off at their job and their income is up and down, so they would be in and out of qualifying type stuff, we're going to make sure we keep those people and continue to help them succeed, as opposed to someone who's bucking the system and rebelling or just quits their job kind of thing.
Right.
There are plenty of things that can disqualify someone from that right. 12 months.
Thank you for that clarification. It's true.
Rely on my vice chairs for their details. So thank you. Can I have a motion?
You bet. Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the -7 amendments dated 3-6 of 2015.
Okay, Vice Chair Peluso moves to adopt the -7 amendments dated 3-6-15. Is there any discussion? If not, so moved. No objection. Okay, if not, so moved. Can I have a motion? Who's doing it now? I guess you're...
Chair Kenny Geyer, I moved to... that's the other one. Wow. You can tell we're new at this.
Where's that mine?
I'm down here now?
Yeah. Okay.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2015 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Stark moves House Bill 2015 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
I have a last note of discussion.
Chair,
I also appreciate the way this bill was written so that if it gets to Ways and Means and they say, no, you can't have $62 million, that there's a lot of flexibility in this bill to change what some of those numbers are, whether it be a 10,000 caseload or 250% exit eligibility, that there is still a lot of room for maneuvering based on what Ways and Means says money is available. So.
well thought out. Okay, further discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Yes.
Excused?
Rep. Gallegos?
Yes.
Rep. Hayden?
Aye.
Rep. Parrish?
Aye.
Rep. Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Palooza?
Aye.
Chair Hagar?
Aye. The motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2233. We held this over last time. Thank you very much for those of you who were here last time for this bill. And Robin, can you please summarize the bill?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2233 directs Oregon Health Authority to continue payments for behavioral rehabilitation services during child welfare investigation, declares emergency effective on passage. No revenue impact, may have fiscal impact, statement not yet issued. There is no subsequent referral.
Okay, great. And I'd like to call up Janet Ahrens, Chris Edmonds, and Philip Cox. Hopefully I got Janet's last name right this time. Okay, who wants to start?
Thank you very much. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We're a statewide nonprofit that takes care of other nonprofits that take care of kids. And that's about $223 million worth of services for children and families and over 100,000 kids. Thank you for rescheduling for an opportunity for us to be able to talk with you about this today. I'd like to start by saying that there's a little bit of confusion here on my part and on my colleagues' parts as well. There is an amendment out, and I saw the piece of paper, but I have not been sent a copy and haven't read or had a chance to look at it, and I think we're all in the same boat. And so I want to start by saying that we're interested in spending some time together to sort some of this, some of these concepts out to see what we can do going forward. So we'd like to put our case on the table and find out what questions or what interest we have in this. So the investigations that occur for providers are an important part of the safety process for kids. And Marie Cervantes, who's the executive director of the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention Investigations, actually came and met at our invitation with our membership last Friday, which we really appreciated. She brought a couple of folks with her, so we were able to get some basic data and information about what OAPI looks like now and what they do and the scope and ways in which they interact with providers. So that was very, very helpful. And so the other important piece of information I want you to have is safety. And to realize that when you're talking with these folks and these providers, that safety is paramount in what we do. Our mission is dedicated to healing children. And that we believe that there should be a higher professional standard for our organizations in caring for kids who we already know, before they even get to us, have already had trauma in their lives. So we have the same goal as OAPI and our contracting partners and the other folks who advocate for and provide work and support for children. So in terms of understanding the impact of an investigation on children and providers, as I understand the data, there are about 600 referrals from the OAPI hotline, and those are referrals of incidents that could be determined as abuse or neglect. There's a fairly wide range of definitions of what abuse or neglect might look like. 4% of those were founded. When you have a founded abuse or neglect, it's possible that a child was injured or had broken bones, that there was serious neglect, that there could have been inappropriate sexual contact, other unprofessional conduct. So this can be very, very serious. It can also be circumstances where a child might have been left unsupervised for a very brief period of time, like 10 minutes. But if the the treatment plan indicates her to have 24/7 supervision, then that's then that can be a founded neglect, as in one example. So what happens when an investigation occurs, even before there are any findings, is that staff is reassigned. Staff that were involved in the reporting of potential abuse or neglect, they're reassigned. And that seems pretty straightforward to be a good idea. However, it does disrupt relationships, it does disrupt treatment, and it slows a child's progress. So we're not saying that staff shouldn't be removed or reassigned. We're just trying to explain that there are other impacts that happen throughout this process. It creates tension and concern among the staff. Sometimes there are staff gets they get anxious, and we have to be really, really careful to support them, and they're doing good work, and that they're appropriately supervised, and that they have a good professional conduct. The secondary impacts include potential of having trouble meeting staffing ratios and other contract requirements. There's also fiscal impacts with the potential of additional overtime costs or additional staffing, and if children are removed or if referrals are stopped until the investigation's completed, there's a loss of basic revenue sources. When children are removed, which sometimes happens, that creates additional trauma and impact on the kids themselves. Usually it means probably at least two more moves, because they're going to be put in a temporary setting, and then they're going to be moved into another permanent appropriate treatment setting. Senator Shields talked in his testimony on Monday a little bit about the trauma that it creates for children when they're moved, and of course there's a disruption in services. So you can see that we're very, very motivated to do good work and maintain professional high-level standards, and that these are just good examples of why safety, on a really practical sense, is very important to us, even outside the mission of the organization, which is to keep all children safe and to heal children. So what should we do? We have three suggestions inside the bill. One is shorten the investigation period. The administrative rule says that the investigations must be completed in 30 days. Now, those are work days. So if you have an average, which I believe is, and you can help me with this, Chris. Any of these citations, Chris can help me with if I'm off on them. The average investigation period is 45 work days. That's 2 months. Plus, 44% of them have extensions on them. So the two main reasons for extensions for the investigations are that law enforcement is involved, so obviously they have precedent there, and we're not going to commingle those investigations. And the other would be that witnesses are unavailable. Now, I'm not exactly sure how witnesses can be unavailable when there's an investigation going on and they're called to participate in that investigation. And maybe there's something on the part of the provider system that can make sure that staff is available. I'm not sure if these are interviews that are scheduled or exactly what the process is, but it seems like there might be some strategies for shortening up the number of times that happens. So we'd like to take a look at shortening the investigation period. The second option is an administrative finding. Right now, you have a finding of abuse or neglect, you have a finding that's indeterminate, and then you have no finding. And what we're looking for is an additional level of accountability for a provider that would create the option for lower level offenses. It could be that you name calling, raising your voice to a child, unprofessional conduct, not complying with some elements of the treatment plan and error procedures, and helping a child de-escalate. Those are infractions that a child may not have been injured, there may have been no repercussions, but there certainly could have been. So we need more training, we need more supervision, maybe we need to evaluate whether or not this person is in the right place in a relationship with children. So the label of a founded abuse or neglect is a very powerful and devastating label. And if it happened as a result of a low-level offense, that's another reason that we would like to see good professionals kept inside the field with an opportunity for more support and more training instead of losing them entirely. The other challenge with a finding of abuse and neglect is that an administrative finding might be more, appropriate, is that even though OAPI doesn't require a termination for most of those findings, often a provider will, or their board will, or their insurance carrier will, or their risk manager will. So there are still fairly significant repercussions for folks for whom we may be able to provide better support without having to lose them entirely. And then third, the challenge when intake is closed or children are moved out for the provider is that essentially that lost revenue is a penalty without a finding. Now, to go back to my earlier example, there are plenty of times when it's really clear what the outcome of an investigation is going to be. But there are other times when it's not clear, and there are other times when it's difficult to determine whether what the impact is going to be on the other kids or whether it's really necessary to stop intake altogether. So a partial payment, we believe, would help keep the lights on and keep key staff working. As you know, because you hear everybody, all of us talking about it every day in here, providers operate on thin margins, and losing revenue for a period of time while you're waiting for an investigation to be completed and you don't know what the investigation finding is going to be makes it really, really difficult. So clearly there's more work to do, not only on the technical aspects of the bill, but also on what we can do to reduce abuse and neglect. And that's really our target with this bill, our new tools and new strategies.
Question.
Yes, thank you, Chair Kennegeier. Can you put some numbers in context of how many cases we're talking about where there's what you're calling the higher level of abuse and neglect versus these lesser charges, and just be more specific about what that is?
Chair Kennegeier and Representative Taylor, I can't. We have been challenged with schedules between OAPI and ourselves to try and get the data and the information they have, and they were able to provide quite a lot of it at our meeting with the membership on Friday. Mm-hmm. And we've worked to set out another bigger meeting with them that would have the contractors and licensing at the table. That unfortunately took about 3 months to put together, so we are only scheduled at this time to have one meeting during the duration of the legislative session, and that will be in April. But we're hoping at that meeting to get the data to be able to drill down to answer questions like yours, because we have them as well, and also to understand what everybody's roles and responsibilities are, because there are several moving parts in how these investigations occur. And there are fines that are levied against providers. There are other interested parties that are not state agencies, like Disability Rights Oregon, who may have an interest in participating in an investigation. And then, of course, we're interested in seeing collaboration between those parties to produce the best corrective action that's coordinated so we can get the right outcome from an investigation.
Follow-up? Thank you, Chair Kennegeier. Are there any laws around right now requiring employees to be informed of what the abuse and neglect laws are, so that they understand that currently if they yell at a patient or something, they are subject to an investigation? I mean, do they currently understand? Are they told this before they start their position, or how is this information communicated to the employees?
Well, Chair Kennegeier and Representative Taylor, I don't know how it is communicated, but they are all subject to training, and part of that training is understanding what the rules and regulations are.
So they are required to go through training, and that information is conveyed. So employees know what the rules are, that if they yell at a patient, they could be subject to an investigation.
Chair, can
you use that example? Taylor,
yes. They are subjective findings, and they are subjective circumstances. So it is not crystal clear. That is one of the challenges with the system, and each part of the system has a different role in a different way and a different lens of looking at these circumstances.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Stark.
If I may want to respond to that question, then I have a question here. An example, to my understanding, as far as like in residential treatment world, where a need for additional classifications could be, over the years, the type of restraint training that someone receives is different. Okay, the last training I had was organ intervention systems, which was significantly different than the training I had at the same agency when I was 19, which was called PART training, professional assault response training. And so, the OIS was much more progressive or is a much healthier system than the PART training was. But someone who's been there for 20 years, who's been using PART training, and all of a sudden now they're not allowed to use those restraint techniques, and they go on and use those even in a new system, someone could say that is abuse. You're not allowed to do that. And according to new standards, yes, that would be appropriate. But it's also appropriate that you work with that staff to train them differently rather than a founded case of abuse. Okay, so there are things like that need kind of their own category. So I'm understanding what you're saying on those things. My question, because that's all separate from what this bill in front of us talks about. This bill in front of us talks about continued reimbursement if someone is removed. I've asked around some, and so maybe you can clarify, or maybe this is the numbers you're waiting on. My understanding, most of the time in a facility, if it's not the child that's removed, it's the staff person who gets put on administrative leave during the investigation. So how often are the children actually removed in this sort of a scenario?
Chair Kennegeier and Representative Stark, I don't know what the actual data is, and maybe Chris can give it to us or we can bring it back to you, but the numbers are low. And there's two pieces here. The numbers are high when it comes to removing staff. That's a requirement when an investigation is started. So all staff are either reassigned or sent home. So that piece is clear. The piece that challenges the providers the most is when they do stop intake or they remove one or more children, the loss of revenue. And that is the subject line that they put on the title of the bill. But the bill is really about all three of these pieces.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you. It's very thorough.
Good afternoon, Chair Kennegeier, members of the Committee for the Record. My name is Philip Cox, Assistant Director of the Oregon Youth Authority's Community Services Division. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill, first of all. I'd like to recognize the 22 not-for-profit agencies with which the Youth Authority contracts across the state to provide behavior rehabilitation services to youth offenders in the care and custody of OYA. These community providers are essential partners in our agency's mission to hold youth offenders accountable and to assist young people learn and develop skills to lead productive, crime-free lives. I'd also like to recognize the financial challenges programs can experience after serious complaints or reports of abuse. If a youth offender alleges abuse, it's the practice of this agency to request the provider to move the person in question from contact with other youth. The person is not allowed youth access until an investigation is completed by OWAPI or by law enforcement. There are very rare instances where complaints are of such a nature that the youth authority deems it necessary to remove all youth while an OWAPI investigation is underway. These youth are typically placed in other programs until the agency receives findings from OWAPI and determines appropriate next steps. OYA, DHS, and providers have established a work group to discuss a number of different ways in which investigative processes might be accomplished more efficiently. I think that all members of this partnership look forward to exploring how to reach the best outcome for providers and for youth. I will say that, as Ms. Ahrens indicated, we received Dash 1 amendments to the bill 30 minutes before the hearing today, and it is substantially different from what was originally proposed, and I have not had the chance, nor have staff had the opportunity to really analyze the differences between the Dash 1 amendments and what was originally filed. And so I would ask that the committee perhaps allow the partnership to enter in some dialogue before coming back. Thank you very much. I'll be more than happy to answer questions you might have.
Any questions? Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Edmonds. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Department of Human Services. I'd like to just echo many of Mr. Cox's comments prior to mine. I came here prepared to speak to House Bill 2233 as we'd originally seen it. We became aware of the Dash 1 this afternoon as well. DHS is neutral on House Bill 2233, the original bill. As written, it would require OWAPI to complete abuse investigations of private child caring agencies that contract with the Oregon Health Authority to provide residential treatment services to children with psychosocial, emotional, or behavioral disorders within 60 days. As mentioned, the Dash 1 is dramatically different from that, and we really haven't had time to assess it. The agency does understand that providers have an interest in timely resolution to investigations of abuse investigations. We also share in a commitment to ensuring the safety of children who are within those provider facilities. In most cases, OWAPI is able to meet the standards that are set out in this bill. However, there are circumstances in which an extension to an investigation is necessary. Such as when law enforcement is conducting an investigation, material witnesses are unavailable for interviews, new evidence is discovered, or consultation with experts is required. We've been encouraged, I would say, by the conversations with the Children's Alliance, and we'd welcome the opportunity, if granted from this committee, for further discussions around a solution that addresses circumstances in which a rigid 60-day timeline is not achievable, as well as, in light of the Dash 1, a broader discussion around this issue.
Okay, I think that sounds good. Looks like there's some more conversations to be had before you come back before the committee, and we'll look forward to hearing that. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2233 and open a public hearing on 2414. Robin, could you please summarize the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2414 allows Department of Human Services to add genetic siblings of adoptees to voluntary adoption search registry, defines rules for addition of and search of minor siblings on registry. No revenue impact, may have fiscal impact statement not yet issued. No subsequent referral. And I think you have the witness sheet.
The witness sheet.
Yep.
I'm calling up Kathy Prouty.
Prouty, yes.
From DHS.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Prouty. I'm the Child Permanency Program Manager for the Department of Human Services, the Child Welfare Division, and I am here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 2414. Child Welfare operates the mandatory adoption search and registry program, and we've been doing that for a number of years. The search program permits a confidential search for a sought-for individual upon the application of a authorized requester. So, for example, an adult adoptee is an authorized requester and could contact the department and ask the department to search for a certain individual, let's say a birth father. The department would conduct a search for that individual, and if found, would ask the individual if they desired contact with the requester, in this example, the adult adoptee. And if agreed, then we would put the two together. And that's how the search program works. The voluntary registry program is a registry where eligible persons can register ahead of time for their willingness to have contact with each other. So if one party registers and a second party registers, then we can automatically provide identifying information to those two parties. So since operating the program, the department has identified barriers for certain individuals to use the program. And specifically, there is a barrier for minor adoptees to use the program, their genetic siblings, and then the progeny or the descendants of deceased adoptees, genetic siblings, and birth parents. And those are the users of the program. So current statute today only allows siblings that are separated by adoption to search for one another if the birth parent has already registered with the program, if the birth parent approves the contact, and if all of the adoptees and the siblings have reached the age of 18. And this bill would allow the adoptive parent of a minor adoptee to make the decision to use the search and registry program in order to have their adopted child try to find or get a connection with a sibling who was separated in adoption. If that sibling is living with the birth parent still, then that's not allowed. This would be siblings that are separated by adoption. One adoptive parent and a second adoptive parent would give permission for those two siblings to search and find each other, and they would not have to wait until the age of 18. In addition, the current statute as it's written, it places a limit on individuals who can use the search and registry program when the parties to the search and registry are deceased. And again, those parties are adoptees, genetic siblings, and birth parents. So today, only the adoptive parents of a deceased adoptee and the parent or adopt a sibling of a deceased birth parent may use the registry. It gets a little confusing. But again, for example, if an adult adoptee dies, their children, their descendants, would be are unable today to use the registry to search for their birth relatives, a birth grandma, grandpa, aunts, uncles. And so this bill would change that. In the same way, if a birth parent is deceased, their children, who they may still have custody of, today, they are not authorized to use the search and registry. So this really just opens up the registry and the search program for additional family members to be able to contact each other, and specifically that is the descendants of deceased parties. This bill also fixes an unforeseen barrier that occurred with the passage of Senate Bill 623. That was a bill that passed in the last large session, and it went into effect January of 2014. And that bill opens sealed court adoption records for adult adoptees and birth parents. The problem is many of those parties didn't know the county, the court of jurisdiction, where their adoption finalized. And this Senate Bill 623, the department records remained closed. So people were calling us, asking us for the county in which their adoption finalized or their court number, and we were not authorized to give that information. And so this bill would allow us to give these requesters information so that they can go and get a copy of their adoption record that they are now allowed to get. And then finally, the bill just cleans up some inconsistent language. There is some inconsistent language in terms of who can use the search service versus who can use the registry service. So we've cleaned that up in this bill. And it also removes the requirement when conducting a search, the department or the department's contractor, we contract this service out, that search should be done in person. And with all of the technology, we think that that's not necessary. And so we want the bill to reflect that it would be permissible to do online searches and using social media, et cetera. And then finally, the counseling that's connected with the registry, in the statute today, it says it needs to be provided by a social worker only. And we would like to change that so that the folks that we contract with are not always social workers, and we want them to be able to provide the counseling to the parties when they're searching for one another. And that's it, and we would request support for this bill.
Representative Taylor. Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. I just have a question. So is this going to be starting from this point forward? Is this retroactive? meaning since ever since the state's been involved in adoptions.
Yeah. Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Taylor, this would be retroactive to all families.
Okay, follow up. Yep. So let's say a woman has a child and gives it up for adoption, and then that woman dies, and that child's still alive and wants to find out who their birth mother was. But the mother, when she gave the child up for adoption, didn't want to be found, did not want the child to know who she was. Would this, under this, this would negate, I mean, when she gave the child away, she was told maybe the child could never find you. We'll never know who you are. Would this now change that?
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Taylor, I think your question is around a child who is still living with the birth mother when the birth mother is deceased?
Or child or adult.
Okay. So,
Adopted.
Adopted child.
It's not living with the birth mother.
Not living with the birth. So a woman gives birth. She gives her child away for adoption. The child is a minor or an adult. But when the mother gave the child up for adoption, she said, I don't ever want to be found. I don't ever want anyone to know that I had this child, for whatever reasons. Then with this change, would a child who's a minor or an adult that's been adopted, would they be able to then find who their mother was?
So Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Taylor, the passing of Senate Bill 623 during the last large session already opened the ability to do that. So adult adoptees are able to go to the court and get a copy of their sealed adoption record today once they turn 18. And that sealed adoption record has their original birth certificate in it, identifying information about their parents. So Oregon has already made the decision that we are going to open up adoption records in the same way, and that is also retro to all families. Okay. In the same way a birth parent can do the same. Now, this bill does not allow minor siblings to contact their birth parent.
Okay.
Until they, that doesn't change in this bill. It allows siblings to find each other who have both been adopted, but if a sibling lives with a parent, then the sibling cannot use the registry to find that other sibling.
But two siblings that are adopted by two different families, those adoptive parents have to agree to find each other.
That is correct. Okay. Those adoptive parents would have to agree. They would be the persons contacting the registry.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question following up on that. They need to have their adoptive parents' permission until they turn 18, and then they would no longer need it?
Right. Chair Kenny Geyer, that is correct.
Okay. Do you have any questions about this? The first category of people that you talked about, which is before they had to get their biological parents' permission, and now it has to be adoptive parents' permission. If there's a, did I get that correct? That you're shifting it to the adoptive parents. Does that mean while they're still minors, if the adoptive parents give permission and the biological parent did not want to give permission, do the adoptive parents override the biological?
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, if I'm understanding your question, the adoptive parent of a minor adoptee,
right, a minor,
and the adoptive parent of the sibling have to give permission regardless of the birth parent's wish.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
But if the sibling is living with the birth parent, then it's not allowed.
Okay.
It is a complicated piece of legislation.
Right.
I agree.
And another question, just in rough numbers, you mentioned several different categories. That was one. There was a middle one, which I'm forgetting now, and then there was the one following the death. Do you have rough numbers of the kind of people who are? Oh, I know one was the people that were because of 623 now are coming to you because of the county versus state. Do you have rough numbers of how many people are coming to you to make these kind of requests and right now can't get that kind of information until this law is passed in each of those categories, the adoptive versus the biological parent, the county, and then the death one?
Yeah, Chair Kenny Geyer, it hasn't been a large number. It's probably been less than 10.
Okay.
But for those individuals, we've been unable to help, and so it's been it's a problem that we want to clean up.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2414 and open a work session. Before I open the work session on the next one, I want to see if someone will move to suspend the rules to allow Representative Evans to vote on House Bill 2015.
You are excused.
So moved. Representative Evans, how would you like to vote
yes.
on the... Okay. I think I had to do this. Clerk, have you gotten recorded? That was for 2015, ERDC.
I said again. Yes.
All right. I'm closing the suspension of the rules on 2015. That was not scripted, so I hope we did that correctly.
Close enough.
I'm giving you a heart attack.
Thank you for letting me do that.
I wanted you on record.
Madam Chair, I can't say we could pause and check it if you want to. So okay. I would suggest.
I think we'll plow ahead, and I'll get in trouble later. We're gonna open. Okay, we're gonna open the work session on 2031. Robin, can you please summarize the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2031. As you may recall, we heard the bill on February 18th. The measure establishes a pilot project for in-home rehabilitation of juvenile offenders at the Oregon Youth Authority, authorizes contracting with nonprofit organizations, directs OIA to evaluate projects, and reports findings to the legislature by 2017. Requests appropriation. The pilot sunsets on June 20th, 2017, declares emergency effective on passage. There is a -3 amendment that defines youth as a person who is at least 10 years of age who is alleged to have committed an act in violation of law or ordinance.
I don't remember who was coming. Someone is here to explain the -3s.
I might.
Oh, no.
Would you like to come up and explain the -3? Thank you.
Sorry, Representative Hack is
not able to be here
and felt like they were simple enough, but she didn't say who she sent to explain the -3.
Does she also want to be texted to come?
She said she can.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Christina McMahon. I'm the Juvenile Services Division Director for Multnomah County. The reason for the amendments are to clarify the population, the definition of youth, to make sure that we were clear about who was to be served by this pilot if this bill were to be passed. And specifically, we want to make sure that we're serving youth who are within the age range, as you've just heard, over 10 years old or over, but also youth who are already involved with juvenile departments. And we think that in the first version of the bill, it wasn't clear enough to establish that this pilot would also serve youth who are currently on probation with the juvenile department in a county. So that's the reason for the definition clarification. The other part of it, which is adding the section that says, except that the authority cannot use funds that are allocated directly to counties, is to make it clear that the funding for this cannot come from funding such as our basic services funding that is passed down to counties passed down from the Oregon Youth Authority to individual counties. It can't come from that, or also the diversion funding, which is passed down from the Oregon Youth Authority and allocated by population to individual counties. So we wanted to make it clear that to fund this, the Oregon Youth Authority would not be able to take money from those other designated funds. So, and that was after input from our colleagues in the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association.
Thank you for that. Are there any questions about the -3? And my understanding is we're not considering the -1 or the -2. The -3 are the only.
The -3 is the combination of -1 and -2 simplified into one.
Okay.
Right.
Great. Any other questions? All right. May we have a motion? I think someone's enthusiastic.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the -3 amendments dated 3/12 of 15.
Okay, Vice Chair Stark moves to adopt the -3 amendments dated 3/12 of 15. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted. Can we have a motion on the bill?
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move House Bill 2031 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Stark moves House Bill 2031 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Oh, I'll just add that I think this is a fantastic bill. Thank you, and thank you to Representative Hack, who is in another committee hearing. and Representative Bueller, who's another sponsor of this. I think it's a really exciting way to try to meet the needs of kids, not only in the facility, but also in their home, and change the whole context in which they live and affect their siblings. And I look forward to seeing results of the pilot project and hopefully expanding it. So, clerk, can you please...
Do we need a carrier?
Well, we need to vote on it first. Can you please call the roll? You are eager.
Yes. Yes.
Yep.
Rep. Hayden?
Yes.
Rep. Perry?
Aye.
Rep. Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Palooza?
Aye.
Chair Klingeyer?
Aye. The motion passes, and would you like to be the carrier? We don't need a carrier because it's got to go to Ways and Means. Well, we'll put in a plea there that you get to carry it. Put in a special message to Ways and Means to have co-carriers Hack and Stark. Okay. We are going to be close the work session on 2031. We are going to roll over the work session on House Bill 2232. We do plan to move that, but the fiscal work or the paperwork is not yet in order. And I think that brings us.
Can we pause for just a moment?
We are going to pause for just a moment.
Kevin.
Miller and John Mullen, please.
They have battleships out of the dinghy.
We were aiming to start at 4, and we're right about there.
Boat.
Pretty good.
And Ty's bringing down this boat.
I've been getting swamped today because of my.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erica Miller. I'm a program manager with the Department of Human Services, Aging and People with Disabilities, Collaborative Disability Determination Unit. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about the General Assistance Study. I believe you've all received a copy of the study. Prior to discussing the report, I'd like to acknowledge that some of you may be unfamiliar with general assistance, and I'd like to provide just a little bit of background about the program in Oregon. The department's general assistance program ended in 2003. It was briefly refunded.
Sit back just a little. You don't need to be too close.
Sure. Sorry about that.
Right.
It was briefly refunded in 2005, and then it ended again. In its final iterations, the program served adults with severe disabilities without minor children in the home. Clients, as a condition of eligibility, were required to pursue supplemental security income, which is SSI, benefits. And the GA program provided a medical assistance benefit through the Oregon Health Plan Plus program, a cash benefit of $314 a month, as well as professional level assistance in obtaining Social Security benefits. Once clients were awarded SSI benefits, which could take months to years, the department was reimbursed for all or a portion of the client's benefits, the cash benefits. When the program ended, clients were transitioned to a different medical benefit, and their cash benefits ceased. And that brings us to today. During the 2014 session, as a part of APD's special purpose appropriations, the general assistance study was funded, and the department entered into an intergovernmental agreement with Portland State University's Regional Research Institute on Human Services to conduct the study. The study commenced in June of last year, and the project concluded in January with the submission of their report. The study included wide stakeholder participation, with John Mullen acting as stakeholder lead. And Karen Solarius, who is here today, was the lead for PSU. Karen is here today to tell you about the report and the study findings. I want to thank you again for the opportunity to be here today. Are there any questions for the department before I hand it over to Karen?
Nope. Thank you.
So, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Solarius, and I am a senior research associate at Portland State University Regional Research Institute for Human Services, which is a mouthful. It's part of the School of Social Work. And I'm here today to present the findings from this study that we were asked to conduct on behalf of the legislature. Am I the one that does the page down on these? I want to point out the talk a minute though about the graphic on this report, because it's a bridge, and we talked a lot about how general assistance is really a bridge for people who have experienced the onset of a disability and have that has prevented them from working, and the wait period that they experience in qualifying for federal disability benefits. There are about 30 states right now that provide disability general assistance. That's where it comes from, is the state funds. However, as Erica said, it is then reimbursed by the federal government retroactively back to the time of the application. So we completed this study in between June and December, and we looked at many different sources of information. We spoke with over 100 people from 11 Oregon counties and 7 different states that have general assistance programs. We spoke with childless adults with disabilities, and we spoke with key informants in the areas of disabilities, physical and mental health care, employment, corrections, and veterans affairs. And the reason that we spoke with those people is because disabilities cross many different areas and affect all of these fields. And then we also talked with researchers and administrators in Utah, Washington, Nevada, and Vermont. So these were the questions that we were asked to answer in the study. So we were asked to answer what already exists within Oregon and other states, what is the need today, and what potential program structures and funding options might address the needs of the target population while also addressing any barriers from the previous program. So Erica provided a good background on the history of general assistance in Oregon. The funding stopped in 2005. And so what we found when we were talking with people about and reading background documents on this topic is that federal disability benefits are available, but the application process is really rigorous and lengthy, and it makes them hard to get, and people often have to apply multiple times before they actually receive that disability benefit. Childless adults with severe disabilities have multiple needs that make it more difficult to go through this process. Often they are already struggling with a disability. They may have they've lost their employment, they may have lost their housing, they don't have funds, and so that in combination with how challenging the application process is makes it very, very difficult for people to obtain this benefit. And the other thing is that we learned is that these disabilities can be hidden. So people, when you might look at someone who looks completely fine to you, and you wonder what disability does this person have that keeps them from working, and there are quite a few very serious disabilities that just you would not see, including chronic pain, mental health issues, brain tumors, spinal conditions. The list really goes on and on. During this time of waiting and applying, resources to meet just even the most basic needs of this population are limited, and especially in the area of housing. So housing came up again and again as a really key factor, as a key need for this population, and as something that is currently limited. In addition, people felt that lack of housing can exacerbate the symptoms of the disability and make it even harder to obtain federal disability benefits. For one reason, they might move around or lose their address, and then they might just have to start over because the paperwork got lost because they lost their address. As Erica said, the states can provide temporary disability benefits and be reimbursed for them once the federal benefits are awarded. There are a few administrative costs for the states that would not get reimbursed, but these costs could be minimized by utilizing existing programs. And in the study, we asked people for suggestions around minimizing costs, and their suggestions are included in this report. And the other thing is that these administrative costs could be offset by savings in health care, homeless assistance, and public safety. And the other thing is that this program could increase the flow of federal Social Security benefits flowing into Oregon. Part of the suggestions that came out of this study was to be sure that there's a component of assisting people with the application process so that they qualify sooner. So we were also asked for suggestions around what might be a good pilot to test out for a program if you choose to reinstate it in Oregon. And the most common thing we heard is to include housing in it. And Housing First is a model that's being used by a number of states and is being considered by others. As the report points out, the state of Utah conducted a cost-benefit study, and they found that the cost of providing housing and a social worker to somebody who is in need of assistance is much lower than the cost of that person would have of emergency department visits and jail time were they homeless and on the street. So the pilot, we suggest that housing be part of the model. And then in order to reduce cost, you could enroll and serve participants from the existing statewide presumptive Medicaid caseload. Those are people that the state has already determined will most likely qualify for federal benefits, so you won't lose out on the funds of sponsoring them. And also it'll get all around the state because it can be operated from the state offices around the state. You can see what the effects are around there. There are existing staff who are familiar with this, so it wouldn't be too hard to put it into place. And also, the benefit of a pilot would be to test out some of the ideas and suggestions that were made in the report and ideas that other people have, and also to see what the true costs of the program are for the state, and also what potential outcomes might be gained. So I'm going to leave you with this last slide, which is some quotes from people that we spoke with. These are childless adults with disabilities from around Oregon who were sort of just sharing what their life is like in their perspective. So I'll let you read them. Oftentimes, you know, the person says, I was a very proud person. It was difficult for me to ask for help. That comes up again and again. And also the fact that benefits don't cover clothes and toiletries. And in addition, if somebody has an assistance animal, like a dog, there's no benefits that would cover the food or veterinary care for that assistance animal. That doesn't come from anywhere. So as you can see, it's quite a difficult time for people. And this program would definitely fill a need. Are there any questions?
Yes, Representative.
I just have a quick question. It has to do with eligibility. Does one have to have participated in Social Security in order to be eligible, or is that a requirement at all?
Yes, Representative Gallegos, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee.
Not too close.
I'm so sorry. I'm a musician. It's my.
That's right. That's right.
That's right. Exactly. You're never close enough. Eligibility historically for this program, one would have to be eligible for SSI benefits, which does not require a work history. So essentially, most individuals end up being eligible for that piece. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'm going to try to tamp down my enthusiasm a little bit, but I want to start out with a number of people that I want to thank. And I particularly want to thank former Chair Carolyn Tomei for persevering with us over all the years we were back in front of this committee with different members, talking about this issue, getting really terrific response from the committee, bipartisan support for moving ahead with general assistance. But it always returned to a discussion of ways and means about how many dollars were involved in creating this program. This is why we're going to be talking a little later about the bill and the pilot. But some additional people I want to thank is that I definitely want to thank my colleague at DHS, Erica Miller, who's been terrific to work with all the way along, and then also Karen and her team for the really terrific work on the report. And I also want to thank my long-suffering GA Steering Committee members, and you'll hear from a few of those people today, that also hung in there for all of this time. The reason that we've done so, and I want to go back to Karen's comment about the cover, because judging the book by the cover is something that I would encourage people to do. We're thinking about this. We had some discussion about what we wanted to do with just framing the report. And Karen mentioned not only the bridge, but a bridge for a better life for people. But also we wanted to make sure that this didn't convey just simply an urban issue, because as you go back to your districts, you will find people in every one of your districts that meet the criteria that we're talking about here. People who are often homeless, many times mental health, as well as long-term disability conditions. They wind up cycling in and out of emergency rooms, in and out of local jails, and sometimes wind up in situations that are even worse than that. And it's simply because we have not had this process in place of helping people to get to a more stable life. So if you can imagine for a moment what general assistance used to be like, where people were able to get this assistance and get on disability benefits and have a life that would be one of dignity and where they could be as self-sufficient as possible. And right now we don't have that component in place. I also pointed out in testimony that I gave you, which probably has more history than you'd ever want to know about general assistance, because its roots go way back to the Depression, when we talked about working with people that had no visible means of support during a real economic crisis. Well, for the folks that are in this category, they're in a really almost a permanent state of crisis. And also, since 2005, things have changed pretty dramatically. When we just think about things that have happened here in Oregon, we have, of course, veterans who have returned from Iraq and Afghanistan. We have the development of the coordinated care organizations that now has in their charge these people who are on Medicaid but having no visible means of support and oftentimes no place to live. They're charged with providing person-centered care, and they don't have a fundamental important mechanism of helping those people get disability benefits. So I just really want to reassure the committee that in all of the discussion that we had, and we had lots of discussion, because I also want to thank the state agencies that were engaged in this, because it was not only the Department of Human Services, but it was the Oregon Health Authority, it was Oregon Housing and Community Services, Oregon Department of Veterans Administration, and also the Department of Corrections. And what we came around to, and we'll talk about this more during the discussion about the bill, about what would make the most sense with us getting started with working with this population again. And we picked out a group that is the poorest of the poorest of the poor. I've often referred to the general assistance population as the poorest of the poor. And the population that we have chosen to work with in this pilot that we'll talk to you about in a minute on the bill is a population that's already identified by Department of Human Services as being in the presumptive Medicaid caseload, but also being being homeless. So we'll talk more about that in a bit, but I'd be happy to respond to any questions, and I'd be happy to talk on and on about this if you would let me. But I'm sure I don't have to subject you to that this time of the day.
I'm going to just throw out some questions and not expect you to answer it, because I know we have a lot of people who are coming, and they may answer some of these questions, and maybe at the end, if there are questions that you feel haven't been addressed, you can come back up.
Madam Chair, thank you, because I plan to be here through the whole.
Great.
And I'll be here.
Because we have six people, so I'm just going to say some of the questions I have about this program. I'm also very enthusiastic about this program. Because of listening to testimony a couple of years ago in which people talked about losing a job and just the months and months and months it takes to get on the federal Social Security, SSI or SSDI, and how in that amount of time they would go homeless. There were all these problems that would happen, and it would end up costing us so much more, whereas if they had some assistance. So I think, trying to understand how much of the program, what you're envisioning now in terms of a financial subsidy to help tie people over in order to be able to get food, be able to get, all the things that they need to get, which if they're individuals, they're not going to be a part of TANF. So how much of it is for a subsidy versus case management? And one of the reasons I support the pilot now is because we have a very different situation where if these people are in CCOs, there's presumably case management there, so maybe you don't need as much. But, so how you divide your what you're looking at in terms of the proportion between subsidy versus the case management, the staffing side to link people to services in the community, that's one. The administrative costs you mentioned, I'm wondering how you plan to narrow or focus the pilot, how much you are hoping to get, because it's a blank right now, what the cost savings would be if you've done any kind of return on investment, what percent of people typically are turned down, at least in the past, from applying. Most of these people presumably are eligible. That's why you're taking them in. And then you get the feds to pay you back in the end. Is that 98% end up getting it? Mm-hmm. So those are some of the big questions I have. That's a lot of questions right there, and I just throw it out as would love to hear answers. But anyone who can answer any of that in their testimony would be great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any remaining questions at the end, because some of this will become apparent from testimony.
Great.
But I would also just mention that we have an amendment in the works that describes the pilot that would also have a fiscal associated with it when we come back, hopefully, for a work session.
Okay, great. All right. So I'm going to close the informational meeting and open the public hearing on 2194. Robin, can you summarize the bill?
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2194 directs the Department of Human Services to establish general assistance pilot project, appropriates funding to DHS, sunsets pilot project on January 2nd, 2019. There's no revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact statement not yet issued. There is a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, great. Can we call up Patty Whitney Wise, Karen Nettler, and Melanie Calvin, please? Nope. Somebody else? So, Kim Hoynes or Liz, Lisa?
Can they come up as panel?
Sure. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Patty Whitney Wise with Partners for Hunger Free Oregon, and I apologize if I get up and leave right after I testify. I have a 4:30 appointment with Co-Chair Ways and Means. I am here in support of the bill, House Bill 2194. We feel really strongly that many of Oregonians with disabilities are being left behind, and many are being left homeless because we have no safety net program for them in place anymore. Sometimes it will take 1 to 3 years to get those disability payments, especially if they're trying to do it on their own. As you heard, they move around or they get discouraged by being turned down the first time and don't apply again for years and then continue to spiral down. So the solution of general assistance and at a level that will provide them enough money for housing is really where we're aiming to go. And part of that is because the federal government will reimburse those costs once they are approved for disability, and the state recoups between their staffing and the actual cost for the program, about 70% of the funds they invest. So it's a pretty good investment. And then you've got those continued disability benefits coming into the state. You've got a person more stable in their community, and the local economy benefits, too, from those federal dollars coming through for those people. Right now, many of them live in the woods. If they get sick, they're really sick. They go to the emergency rooms. They cost a lot of money, or they may end up in jail. And so this program really can, over time, be shown to save a lot of money as well as a lot of lives. And for those reasons, we feel really strongly that this is an important program and I urge your support. Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer and committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak from a voice of faith. My name is Karen Nettler. I'm a resident of Portland and the board chair for Oregon Center for Christian Voices. We are a faith-based nonprofit seeking to activate Christians on issues of economic and social justice. And we believe we have a clear mandate from Scripture to advocate for those whose voices are not always heard and who usually are not at the table when decisions about public policy are made, decisions that can profoundly affect their well-being. We believe Scripture is clear about God's intended role for government, and it is to assure that the poor, the sick, and the marginalized in our community are cared for and have access to the basic necessities of life. The prophets in the Hebrew Scriptures reserve their harshest words for governments who fail to carry out their ordained role of assuring that the poor and sick are protected. And we believe the success or failure of our systems of government can be judged by how well the least of these are doing. It's probably safe to say that the population that would qualify for this general assistance pilot proposed by HB 2194 is not doing all that well. For these reasons, OCCV supports HB 2194 and sees it as an important step towards restoring a general assistance program serving a portion of the most vulnerable and needy population in our community. In addition to speaking on behalf of OCCV, I'm advocating support for personal reasons. I worked in what is now DHS for over 30 years, came to know this needy population through my work. It was heartbreaking to see the program cut back over the years and eventually abolished, because it truly was the last resort for those who were unable to work, had used up all their resources, had worn out their welcome with family and friends, and were on the verge of or were already homeless. So as a person of faith and as one who has seen the desperation of those potentially who would qualify for the program, I respectfully urge you to support this bill. Finally, OCCV believes that when we care for the poor and marginalized, we are acting on behalf of all of us, helping to create a community where we all have opportunity to flourish as God intends. Whatever our faith tradition or none, we are one community, we are one people, and when one of us is not well, none of us are well. This bill is a small but significant step towards restoring a measure of safety, financial security, and dignity to some of the most vulnerable members of our community. Thank you for listening at the end of your long day.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you so much. Next panel, Melanie Calvin, Kim Hoynes, and Lisa Achilles, please.
I've been sitting in this chair for several years.
Could you say your name for the record,
yes,
please?
Yes. I'm Melanie Calvin from the Assist Program in Portland, and I have I wanted to come and tell you guys that when general assistance went away, it was a turning point in my career. I worked as a paralegal in 2004, and one of our clients came and fell to her knees, saying that her general assistance money was used for her medication and that she feared that she would probably not survive without her medication. So I vowed at that time to do better, to do more if I could. So I'm currently the executive director of a small nonprofit in Portland called Assist, and we help people with the application process. It is a daunting federal application. The fall-off rate is tremendous. People can't manage it very effectively. We work with people every day that are extremely destitute. We work with people all over the state. I met with a fellow last week who was a homeless fellow in Sandy, Oregon, and he was in a convalescent center at the moment because he was found almost comatose from exposure, and they're releasing him today, and I needed to find out where he sleeps in Canby, Oregon, if I need to find him again, when I need to find him again. Our mission is to expedite this application. My folks can't wait 2 years to get these benefits. And so we work really hard at that 70% rate of approval within the first 6 months. Thousands of Oregonians are subjected to this extreme timeline, and I'm just really happy to be here advocating again and to be part of this steering committee to keep working on this. The goal of this is to ameliorate many of these hardships as much as possible, and I want to stress again something that Patty Whitney Wise just said. These people, once they get their benefits again, they become consumers again. They are using that money in their local communities, 100% of those funds, almost 100%. That's all I was going to say at the moment. I was going to keep it short because I know we're working on a timeline here. Thank you so much for working with us to compress this, you know, fit us in again. And at this point, I want to introduce one of my rather new clients. Her name is Kim. And I just want you to remember that Kim's story is not unique. She's here because she knows it's not unique. And with that, I'll let thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Kim Harris, and thank you for letting me share my story today. I've been a career person. I worked at the same company for 28 years. I started out as a customer service representative and worked myself all the way up to a training manager for Oregon and Southwest Washington. Oh, I'm sorry. It's not better. And I did everything I thought was right. I saved my money. I put money in every payday into savings. I did my 401k retirement. I didn't go on vacation. I was a workaholic. And then in October of 2000, my mother had a debilitating stroke. She was completely paralyzed on the right side, and it's basically just my mom and I. And I was told by, I thought it was interesting, I was pulled out by the emergency room doctors, and they kept asking me, do you have any brothers or sisters? And I said, no, it's just my mom and I. And they said, you need to take care of yourself because you're going to be responsible on whether your mother lives or dies, because we consider stroke victims lost causes. And where she's going to go next, it's going to be up to you on if she lives or dies. And I don't mean to be depressing, but I'm just kind of giving you the backup. But so she went to a place, and I was so glad that they prepared me. I was told by two other people that were contracted, her physical therapist and her speech therapist, that said, you need to call work because you're going to have to feed her, you're going to have to wash her, you're going to have to be here 24 hours a day until you get her out of here. And so that was my mission. Mm-hmm. And I did everything in my power. I found her a safe place, and this was something that I was going to have to pay for. So thank goodness I saved. And my mother was in a place, and I was taking care of all her medical bills and making sure she had her medicine and everything she needed. And that was October 2000. January 2001, I had left work to go pick her up for a physical therapy, and I was in a car accident, and I hurt my knee. And I knew it was hurt, but I was just like, tunnel vision. I was like, okay, it hurts, shake it off, you know, you can handle this. I need to go get my mom and take her to physical therapy. And, you know, that's lifting her out of her wheelchair into the car, a lot of lifting. And, you know, I was just like, I can handle it. And so over the years, you know, I was having a dip into savings, and thankfully I had a good job, but it wasn't enough for all of her medical and, you know, paying for a foster care as well. And I'm admitting I did not go to the doctor to get my knee done, taken care of, because I'm stubborn. I thought I could handle it. I really did. And my job was very physical. I was a trainer. You know, I would set up. I would carry heavy equipment. I'd stand for 8, 9, 10 hours a day talking to people after hours, things like that. And it just became to the point where I couldn't do it anymore. I had a lot of travel. I traveled to the East Coast for conferences and meetings. And 3 months I was training in Denver and in Philadelphia. So I'd leave on Friday night or Sunday morning, and I'd fly home every Friday night. And I couldn't carry my luggage anymore. I couldn't walk through the airport because my legs had gotten so bad. And I had, my boss had been wonderful to me. He started letting me not travel very often so that I could, you know, stay off of my feet, hoping that that would help. But then finally in 2008, he came to me and said, you know, I really need you to start training again. We need your expertise, because I have very expensive certifications that the company paid for. And that's why I was driven to keep training as long as I could. And he said, we really need you to get out there and travel again. But I just couldn't do it. I couldn't stand. And so that day I had to turn in my resignation because I couldn't do it anymore. And at that point, it was my savings, it was my 401k, my retirement that I was living on myself. But at that time, I was paying everything from my mom. And I had tried to find other resources to pay for my mom's care, but I was told that it's, you know, it was my responsibility. And I kept telling myself I was just overwhelmed, but I was very depressed. I became very depressed after I stopped working, because that's all I ever knew. I had worked, you know, my whole life. And June of 2013, I found aging and disability for my mom. And I had explained to them, because she was going to be kicked out on the street, I said, I don't have any money. I've used all of my resources. And they took on my mom's case, and she was able to stay in the same place. And so she has the quality care that she needs. My mom's actually doing better than I am. But, and then I was able to live in my apartment that I had lived in for 34 years. So, and I'd always paid my rent on time, and it had gotten to the point in 2014 of last year, March 30th, the owner of the building, he'd been very kind, and for a few months, you know, he let me go without paying rent because I just didn't have anything else to sell or anything like that. And we just had a conversation. He goes, Kim, I don't want to do it, but it's time. And I was like, thank you for letting me stay as long as you have. And so at that point, I had nowhere to go. I didn't have a phone. I had lost my electricity for months before that. So I'd been living without electricity. I had no phone. I had no one coming over. So basically, I was a shut-in. And so on March 30th of 2014, my cousin came over and picked me up. And at that point, she said, you can stay with me for a very short amount of time, but you cannot stay. You cannot use my phone. You cannot use the computer. You just have a bed to sleep in. That's it. So after 2 weeks, it was like, get out, get out, get out. You're not welcome here anymore. And at that point, I did something I never thought I would do. I attempted suicide. And in the hospital, they were very kind to me, and I had some therapists there, and they were just like, what are you doing here? You had a good job. And they just couldn't understand that, how I got to that point. And you know, I tried to explain to them, and then they were very nice, and they got me into a crisis center. It's called CATC, and they were kind there. But the therapist said the exact same thing. He goes, I read this, and you're smiling at me. And he goes, I just don't understand why you're here. You had a good job. And I just couldn't understand why everybody, you know, it was like, where do I belong? And the people there were very kind because I didn't have any insurance. So they were very kind, and they helped me get insurance. And they told me about Social Security, but I was unable to do that because you had a limit of 20 minutes on the computer. So you could not get, you know, spend the time to sign up for Social Security. And unfortunately, I couldn't walk to go do it. And on my last day there, I had been put on a shelter list, but I was 108 on the list. And I had been looking out, knowing my final day there, I've been looking outside and looking for TriMet bus benches. Where can I go sit? You know, and so I had my little purple bag with my one outfit that I had, and I went to leave, and the woman that works there, she goes, I can't let you leave. And I, you know, she goes, we have to try. And so because of her, she called the 211 number, and she called at least four times and calling different people, and she'd get a no, and then she'd call back, and she'd call back. Well, the fourth time she called, she found someone that made the extra phone call, and they got me into SAFES, which is a women's only emergency shelter, and I was on an emergency mat for 3 nights. And so I was able to get to SAFES, and on that third night I was like, okay, I'm going to be out on the streets tomorrow. But then, because it was a beautiful sunny day out, 107 people their names before mine were not there to have their names called and to say, yes, I'll take a bed. So I was that 108th person that was there, and I got a bed by all miracles. And I was so thankful. But for someone with disabilities, it's very scary because there's all different kinds of people. And my very first night there was a fight that night, and I had two people that were fighting and hitting each other with a lock, and they had fallen right onto me. And because I couldn't get away, you know, I need a walker, and I couldn't get away, and I was absolutely terrified. And so for people with disabilities in the shelters, you have to really be aware. And every day that I was there, I would find one spot close to the desk and of the employees. And so if there was a problem, I felt just a little bit safer that an employee was right there, because I couldn't run to get away when problems happened. And but again, at the shelter, you know, certain employees would come and they'd ask me, they're like, you don't belong here. You just don't look like you belong here. And I'm just like, well, what should I look like? Mm-hmm. And then also with the social workers there to help you try to find housing, they were like, well, if you had an addiction problem, we could find you some housing. But because I was disabled and didn't have an addiction, mm-hmm. they said that's going to make things a lot more difficult for us. And I just thought that was very interesting. And, you know, so you really feel like you just don't belong anywhere. And I met some of the most incredibly generous people in the shelters. They're homeless, and yet they'd give you their shirt off their back. And just very, very kind. And I was finally able to go to a doctor. The first doctor I tried to go to, they said I couldn't come in because I didn't have a valid driver's license. It had expired. So I wasn't able to, they wouldn't accept me. but then my therapist at Cascadia, she said, well, I'm going to find you a doctor that will take you without a current driver's license. And so I was able to go into the doctors, and then this person was very, very kind, and they were able to introduce me to Lisa, who you'll hear from next. And she has introduced me to a new world, including Melanie. So I'm starting to get the care that I need, and signed up for Social Security with Melanie's help, and so we're just waiting for the process. But I just wanted to share my story and let you know that I wasn't aware of the resources out there, and the resources I did try to take part of at the shelters, they don't have a phone for you to use, and I didn't have a phone. And so you're told, make a doctor's appointment, look for housing. And I'm like, what do I do? They're like, there's a payphone 3 blocks down. I'm like, I can't walk. I don't have money for a payphone. And so you feel really helpless. And, you know, one of the people from the shelters gave me a new pair of socks to wear today. So it's little things like that. And I used to be a very proud person. And so this is kind of embarrassing. But I just wanted to share my experience. So thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Are there any questions for Kim? Really appreciate you coming to share your story.
So my name is Lisa Achilles, and I am a health resilience specialist for CARE Oregon. And I hear these kinds of stories every day. And so there's a degree to which I'm honored to be able to work with the population that I work with, and grateful for CARE Oregon for being part of the CCO system that applied for a grant that funded a program that I work in. I am one of 18 people who are embedded in primary care clinics in the Portland area. So we are in OHSU, Virginia Garcia, Multnomah County Clinics, the Legacy System in Providence. Our job is to help be a bridge, if you will, to people who are the most medically vulnerable in our system. And so typically that means people who are medically fragile, who may have had at least one inpatient visit to the hospital or have had six or more emergency room visits. We usually work with 20 to 30 people at a time for a period of about 6 to 9 months. And as part of that work, we do have just a very small fund that we can use to spend on the members that we work with. Madam Geyer, you're absolutely right. There is a lot of case management available. There's just not a lot of money to go with it. Mm-hmm. And the reality is I'm allotted roughly $50 per person mm-hmm. to work with for a year. Mm-hmm. And I'm constantly robbing Peter to pay Paul to keep mm-hmm. things going. Mm-hmm. Right now, the cell phone that Kim has is a $25 per month cell phone that I pay for mm-hmm. to keep her going so that she can make phone calls and talk to her mother, who she worked for so hard, as well as make any medical appointments or housing appointments that she needs. What my colleagues and I see every day that might be minor inconveniences for us are major catastrophes for some of our members. For example, 3 weeks ago, I put my Oregon State ID in my pocket with a couple of bucks and went to the grocery store. And when I got there, I realized when I was sitting in the car, I bent the thing. Now, it's frustrating. I'm going to have to replace that someday. And it's going to cost me $40 and some of my time. And it is the best state ID I have ever had in 53 years of living, ever. And yet, for me, it's going to be a major inconvenience. For Kim, it kept her out of a medical visit for a couple of extra weeks. And I see people who are denied constantly because they don't have a valid ID or their ID expired. So sometimes as part of that small fund of money that I pay for people, it's just to get them an ID, to get them a foot in the door. If they are able to find a possible housing resource, then they have to have an application fee that they're paying as well. One of the worst days I had on my job was the day before Thanksgiving last year, where I watched one of my clients get kicked out of her apartment with no place to go. We spent hours trying to find a shelter for her to go to, a place to stay, and there was absolutely nothing. So I ended my day leaving with no place for this person to go the day before Thanksgiving, and my husband and I had already planned that we're going to go to the Oregon Humane Society, where I'm a volunteer, and adopt a dog. The dog that I adopted, Scout, cute little Dalmatian puppy, but this dog had been homeless for 3 days, trucked up from California, and he finds a home in 3 days. But I just left a living human being on the street, and there was nothing I could do for it. So it's just, for me, it was that dichotomy of, I can take a dog into my home, and I know that ethically, with my training, I can't bring in a human being, but there's no place I can take them either, and there are no resources to put them in.
it took everything I had that day not to ask my husband, can we just like maybe take $200 and pay for a Motel 6 down the street for this person? And yet that wouldn't have helped the problem at all. And that would have been one of still a lot of people that I work with who would have had the same issue. I got a phone call. I was sitting in my clinic one day, and I was told by the CMA that I had a client in the waiting room who had just soiled her pants. She's homeless. She had just ruined one-third of her wardrobe sitting there with no resources to replace that. And so I ran down to Rite Aid and bought a pair of jean leggings for $20 and brought those in so that she could have something clean to wear. We had to toss the rest of her clothes because she really had no other place to wash them. If I can find resources to connect people to for housing, they have to get there. And bus tickets are a huge part of that. And so if we have someone who is disabled and if we can get them down to pay for their pass so that they can get an honored citizen's bus pass, which, by the way, is going to be $26.50 a month, you know, there are no resources for that as well. So that, again, can be one of the things that I can, for some people, assist them with. The wheelchair that you see Kim in right now is one that we borrowed for the lobby. I can't get her a wheelchair because she doesn't have an address. As soon as she gets an address, then we can get her the wheelchair that she needs that she can get around in. But meanwhile, we're going to have to borrow what we can or just make do with the walker that I was able to get for her. Transportation is a huge issue for people. It can be one thing to have medical transportation to get people places. And even with that, and thanks to Kim, I learned that if you are in a wheelchair and if you are waiting for TriMet and if there are already two wheelchairs on that bus, you have to wait for the next bus. And it may be two or three buses before you can get to even a medical appointment. And if you're late for your medical appointments in my clinics, they're going to say, sorry, you should have been here on time. Next time, try harder. Over-the-counter medications are just basic self-care needs, lotion, the things that I take for granted. I don't know how many bottles of lotions I have and how many purses, but it costs money and are things that people can't necessarily afford and are not covered by their medical expenses. The telephone that might be the connection to their outside that may give them some independence is something that's not available to them. And then just advocacy with different organizations. It's like every case manager, I used to work at a community mental health. I know how swamped I was with the 83 severely, persistently mentally ill people on my caseload. It was the squeakiest wheel from someone on the outside that got any sort of attention. So that's part of the advocacy that we try to provide for the people that we had. I've had occasions to give sleeping bags to homeless people who there was nothing else to give them for that evening. And it was the best that I could do for them. So even food at times can be a resource that I pick up at a local bank and get to someone.
Lisa.
If the general assistance fund were funded, people would have a little bit more power to be able to give back to the society. So I apologize for the time.
Thank you. You've given a ton of really, really concrete, excellent examples. I just want to make sure people have an opportunity to ask a question, and then we do have one other speaker, and John may want a couple of minutes, and we're trying to get out of here by 5, but really fantastic real-life examples, so appreciate it. Are there any other questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, Philip Kennedy Wong, and then John Mullen, would you like to accompany in case there are any questions at the end?
Madam Chair, members of the Committee for Record, Philip Kennedy Wong. I'm here to testify on behalf of Oregon Food Bank, and I think my colleague John said I had 45 minutes, so I'll try
at
to...
At your peril.
I'll try to shrink it down. I will be very brief.
I think she said 4 to 5 minutes.
Yes. 4 to 5. Maybe 45 seconds.
Yeah, yeah. Really. It's shrinking all the time, so you better hurry up.
So I wanted to start with a personal note. So I have been working as an advocate for folks who are disenfranchised, folks who are, experiencing poverty and hunger for coming upon, I think, 12 or 13 years. And I've been working, actually, on the General Assistance Program, trying to get it reinstated since 2003. And this is, like, my third organization. I first started off with a faith-based organization on this issue, and then, for a local government and back to a nonprofit. And so it is with an honor that I have had the opportunity, but it's also been frustrating, obviously, because it's been that long of a time. And one thing I just wanted to share with you that Oregon Food Bank has been proud to do is essentially help continue this conversation over the years, not just in the state legislature, but among all the many nonprofit organizations and social services that serve your constituents all across the state of Oregon. We've been holding meetings, we've been introduced bills the last couple of sessions, and I feel like we're getting closer than ever. Thanks to the good work of our colleagues, especially John, who has done a great job in sort of educating folks, but certainly, unfortunately, it's taken a long, long time. And just another personal note, I've actually had an experience with the disability application process with my brother, and thanks to Melanie, who's here. So it really gave me a real understanding of some of the barriers. I mean, those applications are very complex, and I just can't imagine if you had disabilities, whether it be physical or mental, going through that process on your own without some sort of, some case management or even support for housing. So that's it for my 45-minute worth of testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center for the record. I'll be brief because I hope that we'll be coming back for maybe another public hearing work session. Just to clarify, as far as the public hearing is concerned, about some elements of the amendments, which you don't have yet. But I just wanted to just get a couple of things on the record, is that the intent, of course, is to work with the Department of Human Services and people that are already identified as being homeless and on Medicaid and very, very low income. So there's already a population to gear up for. It would both be SSI and SSDI that would be in the queue. In other words, some people with work history could get SSDI or a combination of SSI, SSDI, depending on where their income is. We also, under the existing statute, and general assistance never went away statutorily, the funding went away. Under the existing statute, the department had rules that also required people to sign an interim assistance agreement that then we're able to leverage those dollars when they got a settlement from the federal government from the time they applied to when they got the settlement on SSI, SSDI. So those dollars can be returned to the state to pay for the upfront cost. Definitely interested in utilizing that housing first model and also a small personal incidental fund. The pilot would keep the amount of reimbursement below the SSI level so that when a person does get SSI or SSDI, they will be able to then continue to be self-sufficient. The other thing, there's a couple of very obscure things that I'll just mention in passing. One is about estate recovery, and this will be part of the amendment discussion when the bill comes in, is that the intent is not to go back and recover from the estate of people who virtually have nothing, but that's part of public assistance law, and so that'll be a technical thing that we'll talk about. But I'm just really very excited about the more general aspect of getting there, and that we're very much interested in continue to work as a stakeholder group, if this gets funded, with the department to create the right kind of metrics to show success. Because frankly, we won't be satisfied as advocates until we have the kind of program that will work for people all around the state. Lisa, who works with CARE Oregon, there are many more resources in the metropolitan area, but even that and the work of groups like Melanie's group, there's just not enough resource to go around to help these people get disability benefits. So with that, because of the time of the day, I'll be happy to just end there, see if there are any questions, but hopefully we'll come back for another discussion on this.
Yeah, Representative Hayden.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, thank you. One quick question for the Oregon Food Bank. How do we get toothbrushes in those boxes?
Mm. Madam Chair, members of the committee for the record, Philip Kennedy Wong, Representative Hayden. That's a good question. We do get a lot of toiletries that are donated. They usually come in the form of food drives. And so I can follow up with you and chat with you about how we can access, I think hopefully if vendors or organizations are willing to donate a large volume of like dental, equipment, we'd be more than happy to talk about some of the logistics involved in getting it out throughout the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Let's work on it.
I know a dentist who might be able to.
Yes. go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. John, how long, what year did you start coming to the Capitol to work on this?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, the program funding went away in 2005. At that time, I was director of Clackamas County Social Services. We worked in the community to talk about what had happened and the cutback during the recession. So then I started advocating right from that point. I retired in 2006, went to work for the Law Center in 2007, and been at it ever since. And again, I can't say enough for this committee and the folks that were on it every year, really recognizing the need and having a bipartisan sense of support for these programs. And so I'm hoping that before I retire the next time that we will have made some traction in getting services to people who are truly
Chair Kenninger, I just wanted to acknowledge that that many folks here know that I volunteered for Representative Tomei for the last 2-3 years and gotten to know John a little bit better. What I was getting at is how many years have you been coming and working and trying to help those who are less fortunate?
Yes.
And John has devoted his entire life, as far as I can tell, of using your high skill set to fight for those who can't fight for themselves. And I just really want to thank you for that. And hopefully we can get this done. I will be a supporter of this, just for the record. So
I want to echo that and just say that, you know, I used to say, why aren't we just funding this? I think the pilot does make a lot of sense because there are so many different situations now with the CCOs. The whole time that you were telling your story, I kept thinking, well, why isn't there a CCO? Clearly, if your income level is within eligibility of the Oregon Health Plan, where's the CCO? They're supposed to have case managers. And then you stepped in and tell us, you know, okay, now we do have a structure in place, and it's still a fledgling, you know, effort, but it's maturing, and we have that. And so now, if some of those needs are the kinds of things that you, Lisa, pointed out, these are some of the financial needs. We may not have to spend as much in this program on the case management part that we did before. So looking at what the infrastructure is in place so that we're being efficient and we're not creating, you know, duplicative programs, but where are the actual really are the gaps needed where they can make the difference? And I think that's why I have, you know, become more enthusiastic about the pilot, whereas at first I was just like, why aren't we funding the whole thing? So appreciate your efforts. And
Madam Chair, if I might, that's one of the reasons why we honed in on the kind of pilot that we had, because of the infrastructure that's in DHS, the work that we intend to do with community partners, including the CCOs, and just really trying to show that we can be really successful.
Yep.
And we'll also try to identify some of the offsetting costs. The study that was done in Utah basically showed that by doing a housing first model and mitigating some of the other costs, the program actually pays for itself.
Yep.
So
great. Well, we look forward to that. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2194. And next meeting we'll have our public hearings on House Bills 3107, 2239, 2242, 2694. Any other announcements? Nope. Then we're adjourned. Thank you.